Hello and welcome to the Tomorrow Brands podcast, where we explore what it takes to build a brand of tomorrow. I'm your host, Ruth Vitok, and today's guest is Fred Hart, brand strategist and CPG obsessive. In this episode, we dig into what makes a good brand refresh, how founders can avoid costly design mistakes, why influencers are rewriting the brand building playbook, and Fred's five principles for better branding. Let's get into it.
We're very excited to have you. I think you've actually already been on the podcast. You got mentioned in an episode.
It's a great track record, and nothing makes my mom happier than hearing that.
So before we get into it, I'd love to hear a bit more about your background and how you got to where you are now.
Yeah, I started as a designer and cut my teeth in the Bay Area, working for some great firms there, a small boutique and then a slightly larger one. And 10 years ago, moved to Boulder, Colorado, where I currently live, and started a branding and design agency with a former business partner called Interact. That 9-year period we were together, we went from 3 people to 30, offices in multiple locations. It was a great ride. A year and a half ago, I exited the business and have just been independently consulting since. And while I started my career as a designer, I don't do any designing today. I really focus on the strategy of design and really working to understand the future of CPG. I attend probably 12 trade shows a year. Some international. I am obsessive about going to stores and just understanding like where's culture going, where consumers going, what's innovation looking like, what is happening from a design and packaging perspective, and just nerding out on all things CPG.
Yeah, and you share some great updates from all of these shows, and I know you've been to some quite weird and wonderful ones, right?
I just went to a pet food show. I've been to private label manufacturer show. I've been to supplement supplier shows. I'm about to go to Toronto in 2 days, actually, to my first natural product show in Canada, and we'll be speaking at that conference, which I'm pretty excited about.
You've mentioned you've had a long history of design. What was the first project that made you fall in love with branding?
It was before I even knew what branding was. I fell in love with design because of basketball. I still play a lot of basketball personally, and it was always the shoes that my favorite players were wearing that I learned to love. And you dive into the world of Jordan and Tinker Hatfield and the massive brand that has been built around athletes and performance and style and all this stuff. And that, I think, was my first entry point into this world. But I fell in love with, I think, CPG when I was a junior in college. I had an internship at a small design firm in the Bay Area called McLean Design. And their claim to fame was they created Monster Energy Drink, the billion-dollar energy drink brand that disrupted what Red Bull had created and Rockstar. And it was then that I learned the power of brands, particularly outside of the home, things you carry around with you, and how they act as status symbols and forms of identity. And I also loved that packaging was like what I saw as the only form of competitive design. You can design a book or a website or a billboard, beautiful corporate identities, but in packaging, everything is fighting for the same occasion, share of stomach, share of wallet. And I love the chess match that ensued. And that's where I think I found my love of design.
So let's talk about trends, because obviously, as you just said, you go to a lot of shows. So what are your headlines for trends in 2025? Or maybe we should look ahead to 2026, because we're almost done with 2025 now.
Yeah, it really depends on the industry. I've been to candy trade shows, and the trends there are completely different than what the natural product trends versus, of course, pet food. And then I was lucky right after Expo West earlier this year to go to London for the International Food Expo and to see the two very similar sort of markets be vastly different in terms of what was trending in products is fascinating. It's hard to say here are the top line trends, but I think that protein is undeniable. It's being pushed into everything from pasta sauce to sprinkles to ice cream pints to soda. It's getting wild out there. And it begs the question of when will the protein bubble burst? But also, who's actually building around protein with consumers in mind? Just because you can put it into something doesn't mean you should. And I thought the Kardashian brand, Khloe Kardashian's brand, Cloud, that came out earlier this year, that I think was designed by Turner Duckworth, was a pretty fascinating and interesting one, bringing popcorn and protein together in a unique way that actually felt appropriate. I think the rise of influencer-led brands is undeniable, and it is disrupting big food in a lot of ways because they figured out how to build massive audiences first and then leverage that. I, I had the luxury of working with Jimmy, aka Mr. Beast, on his Feastables chocolate brand several years ago, and get a front row view of like just the kind of demand that they can create. And you're seeing it everywhere pop up now. Unwell and Nestle with what Alex Cooper's doing. Name a big name celebrity and they have some sort of products at this point.
I did see that J-Lo had brought out a range of RTD cocktails, but she's a famous teetotaler.
Yeah, she doesn't drink. Things like that just feel so forced. And I think the large problem with celebrity-backed brands versus influencer brands, there's some nuance. There's celebrities don't need these products to sell. They've already made their money. And so there's just a lack of authenticity oftentimes, or misalignment. And for every one celebrity brand that's successful, I'd say there's probably 10 that failed that, you know, no one mentions. It's like all the PR comes out when they launch it, and then it's all quiet when it goes away. But influencers, they focus on building audiences first. And I think they have a little bit more longevity, but how long do they have is the big question.
I feel like for a lot of the influencers, they're so tuned into their communities in a way that celebrities perhaps aren't. And they're getting those sort of, we just actually had a call with a creator who's created a range of sources and got to spend a lot of time testing and learning with the audience, getting feedback, yeah, doing limited drops and listening and creating feedback loops. And because that's how they're used to working with creating content anyway, that they're applying it to product development and they're directly speaking to their consumers, which anyone who works in CPG would say to do versus a celebrity. I don't know why I haven't thought of this sooner, that they're like the genius founders.
Yeah, imagine that, a feedback loop. Wow. Yeah, that's what makes so many entrepreneurs so special, is they find a white space or a problem that they have that hasn't been addressed. And that's also why the large strategics, the Nestle's, the Conagra's, the Mondelez's of the world end up acquiring brands, because they've lost that ability to stay rooted to real world problems and such. And so it'll be interesting to see how can influencers over time continue to scale, and do they hold on to that because of their unique platforms? Or at some point, do people sour on influencers the way they have with celebrities or sometimes athletes too?
Yeah, Prime has been talked about to death here, but it was an amazing example of creating a bubble and then the bubble popping, and not necessarily related to it being a creator-led brand necessarily, or just that hype, like what yes, hype everybody wants, but can easily become your undoing because it's too faddy.
Yeah, I mean, how long can you keep a hype train going? Can it always grow? That's a big challenge. It's interesting. And how can we go a podcast without mentioning Liquid Death? I had this realization talking with some friends the other day that the genius of Liquid Death is they're basically an influencer brand, but the brand is the influencer, not an individual. It's massively more scalable as a result, right? They have the characters and then they have the funny ads. And it's just like really smart that they've managed to figure out that influencer playbook without having the influencer involved.
Is smart. We also had Nick, one of the founders of Midday Squares, on the pod a while ago, and he talked about making celebritizing themselves as founders rather than using celebrity.
That is absolutely true. If you hop on LinkedIn today, everyone is building out in the open, and they are trying to build audiences at the same time they build their brands and have the two sort of connect one another. Because if you're retailers and brokers and all of the people that are gatekeepers within the industry are online watching you do this, then there's already greater familiarity and they feel like, oh, you've already done something. It's quite smart. Sometimes it can be a little noisy on the platform as a result. Sometimes it's more beating their chest than it is providing insight or knowledge. But look, there's an audience for everything.
I think it works when people are genuinely authentic. We have a few founders in the UK who do it really well as well. But they share the highs and the lows, but like genuine lows, not the sort of like humble braggy lows or the kind of glossy lows. And I think that's what people will then feel emotionally invested in. It doesn't work if you just sort
posture, and don't show the roller coaster that is the entrepreneurial lifestyle.
So let's talk about brand refreshers. Interested to get your perspective on this, because the other thing that we talk about is good founders seem to know the difference of when to stick and when to twist, and like when to pivot and when not to pivot. And sometimes these things are only clear in hindsight, as we know anyway, and it's all very easy to say down the line. When do you think is a good time to brand refresh, and when is absolutely not?
I think a good time for brand refresh, if You're getting a lot of feedback from either your customers or your retailers that there are issues with the perceptions of the brand, or that there's a lot of questions that consistently swirl around it. Other times, though, because it's all about like where are you at in your brand's life cycle, sometimes it might be you're going to launch a new product line of innovation and you didn't set up the original brand identity or packaging to encapsulate something beyond. Oftentimes, I think entrepreneurs make the most straightforward decisions possible in the early days, not thinking super big, and they can put themselves in a little box. I find this happens a lot with brand naming, actually. They put the product name in the brand name, and what happens if they want to move away from an ingredient that's in the brand name? Or I actually just posted a little case study today on a company called Hodo that we'd worked with that just got some big investing from a large Asian snacking brand called Kalbi. And Hodo is a tofu company. They used to be called Hodo Soy. And when we worked with them to do a significant brand refresh for them, we said, you need to drop soy from the name. It doesn't do anything. What if you want to use ingredients other than soy at some part? Hodo is the narrative. So drop that. And then, you know, the other parts were like, they had won in kind of the natural channel, but they were looking to win over more. So there was an audience shift and they wanted to win over more mass consumers or start to play in convention a little bit more. So I think anytime there's a lot of questions that swirl around the brand that are misconceived perceptions. Anytime there's a shift in audience or who you're going after, maybe you've won the first stepping stone and now you need to get the second. Sometimes maybe it's moving out of natural and into conventional, or moving from convenience into grocery. So there's a whole lot of things. I try to ask as many questions early because I think, Ruth, you're leading me a little bit with like, how do you know when to tell them no? And I think telling people no is a very powerful thing that earns you a lot of trust if you earnestly believe it. And it's in the best interest of their brand not to do anything. Larger companies, they get a new CMO and they want to put their thumbprint on it and they want to change things. And that can be really dangerous too.
Yeah. It's the brands I've worked on, we've done some pretty big refreshes and they've always been so nerve-wracking because the one I see that does the ones on LinkedIn, and I've never been behind anything like this, but the Tropicana rebrand just gets real. Yeah, saw that one too. And I just feel for the people behind that because it's so public as well, isn't it?
And it creates, incites fear for those that do need to make change, which is tough. I'm a big believer in testing to learn and using research early on in the creative phase. I think where the issue comes in a lot of times is, especially with these larger companies, they do validation testing at the end. Maybe you've got one concept and it doesn't hit all the metrics. And now you're Frankensteining things at the last minute because you have print deadlines and all this stuff. And things just like, you lose the perspective of what you're trying to do in the first place. Or you simply never tested early concepts just to see what you could learn from consumers and bring that into the creative process. I'm also a big believer that people don't read, they recognize. And if you're going to evolve a brand that has product market fit and has scale to it, you need to inherently understand what consumers recognize about the brand and figure out how to maintain that. And sometimes you can move too far, as we've seen. Sometimes it's on the structural design side of things. Sometimes it's on the imagery and visual equities, or it's just politicized, which doesn't help either.
I think it's such a good point about what consumers actually associate with your brand. Remember at Pop Chips, we did quite a dramatic change. It went from being like dark to white and the swoosh. And we did some, and it was being driven by the US, so we had to roll it out in the UK anyway. So it was also like, and I remember we tested it with some consumers and lots of people didn't even notice it had changed because they just recognized the logo. Completely different. It's quite humbling.
Once you understand what is the thing that they recognize, then you know, oh, I can pull all these other levers. And it's like a counterbalancing situation, like the one you were just talking about. Oh, I'm going to move from back to white as long as the logo's there. It's a fixed asset.
Yeah, don't touch the logo. Red flags when you're speaking to brands, when you know a project's in trouble.
When subjectivity is just leading everything, we all bring ourselves to the table, our past experiences. As designers, we have certain tastes and acumen. But that is why I do getting early qualitative feedback from consumers early in the process to make sure to hold everyone accountable to what we're seeing and hearing. Other issues, there's always the budget part of food photography. I think sometimes first-time entrepreneurs who are investing in food photography are shocked by the price tag. But at the end of the day, taste is king. And the best way to communicate flavor and appetite appeal is through world-class photography. And there's a cost of velocities and adoption and trial if you hold back on that side of the equation. And then I think just maybe sometimes not thinking big, largely or broadly enough about what the brand could be can sometimes be limiting. But, you know, what we do is brand therapy. You know that as much. We did it with a prominent jerky brand here in the United States called, now it's just called Archer. At the time when we worked with them, I think in 2019 to do a refresh, they were Country Archer Jerky. And we said, okay, first off, you make more than jerky. So let's take that out of the brand name. In place in Provisions, but Provisions would be small. And then Country Archer, most people knew, like most people wanted a more of a shorthand. So we're going to make Country super small and Archer big. And we'd sold them in that presentation in 2019 of like, hey, what if you just did Archer? They weren't ready for it, but it planted that seed. And then they just did that in their big refresh. And it's just awesome to see brands getting smart and thinking about the future and setting themselves up for success.
Long-term thinking is what we'd like to see. What do you think the fastest way for a small brand to stand out is? We should pick a category, really, shouldn't we? Because like you say, they're all so different. Why don't we choose soda? Because it's just such a tough category.
Ooh, soda. Yeah, soda's exploding. And what soda means, the lines are being blurred now with the rise of Olipop and Poppy and all these other companies. One of my mantras is challenge the category, not the consumer. It is easy to be different for different sake. So I could take a soda brand today and I could say, hey, we're going to own one brand color across all flavors. It's going to be bright magenta. It's going to brand block. You're going to see it. It's going to disrupt its shelf, but it may alienate male drinkers or it might have navigability issues with flavors, et cetera. So I think ultimately you have to look at the semiotics and the design codes of the categories and spaces and ask yourself, like, what's taken for granted and what can we flip? I had seen I'll point to a brand that's been around for a long time, Jones Soda, if you know it at all. It's always a black and white label with a piece of like black and white photography on it and then a big kind of colorful hit. I think if someone were to take the aesthetic vibe and ethos and bring it into soda, it could be really different because everything today is now, every can's a different color and it's all this rainbow Skittles effect on shelf. I think we're going to see the return of brand blocking within soda. Zevia, interestingly enough, in the United States has rolled out two limited edition flavors now, and they're vastly different in design than the core portfolio. And I think it's going to be the long-term strategy. And it's always green up at the top. They've cut the can in half architecturally, always green up top for the brand and then flavor down at the bottom. And I think what's going to do is help them accrue a visual billboard at shelf that'll help them get consideration because what isn't seen isn't sold in retail and you can't afford to get lost. So I think that's a big thing for entrepreneurial entrance into the space is to find a way to be different and disrupt.
This is also making me think that for a while now, I think that vitamin water, as you call it, from the launch of, and this was years ago, and it's you can't find it in market here anymore. I just think it was ahead of its time because A, it was a functional beverage, which has now come back in again, but also it had that amazing rainbow, but then with the massive black and white label.
Yep.
I think it's time to bring it back.
Yeah, they just did a refresh here in the States. They got rid of that half and half architecture. It probably got way too complicated with the amount of SKUs that they had. And now black is just full sugar. White is zero calorie, where I think in the beginning, the core product was white on the top for full flavor, for full calorie, so for sugar. So they had so much success, but they had some baggage and the category language started to change and then they got out of it. Yeah, you're totally right. Vitamin water was ahead of its time. There's a brand called Soylent here in the US that was also highly functional and very differentiated visually. I think the issue there is like it changed hands and then they tried to bring it to mass consumers and it just lost its vision.
Lost its magic.
Yep.
If you were launching a challenger brand today and you had 100K in your pocket, where would you spend the first 20?
Bitcoin. If I had, where would I spend it? I would spend it on the product. I tell clients all the time, the fastest way to kill a brand is to have a great design and horrible product because you'll get trial and no repeat purchase. And they have to make sure that what's inside of the can, the box, the bag, gives itself the best chance to win with consumers' tastes. You can have horrible packaging and slowly grow as a brand because you have a great product because people will share it via word of mouth. And you'll be skeptical and it creates hurdles because it won't have organic trial to it. But there's trust if someone tells you to try this thing and it exceeds expectations. The worst thing is undermining expectations. Great packaging. You're like, this was horrible. I'm never spending my money on that again.
I did experience quite a lot of that last time I was in the US, actually. I feel like I was in like an Erewhon and I bought some like collagen protein bar thing. And I was really excited about it. And I was like, this is disgusting. I had to make it on shelf because it tastes so bad. It feels like the kind of taste barrier to entry is a little bit lower there than it is here. I don't know how brands get away with it.
Yeah, fortunately, Erewhon is not most people's reality. I love it for seeing what innovation looks like and things, but I think there's so many bleeding edge entrepreneurs that sometimes the story of what's not in the product or who's bringing it to market or what trendy no seed oil things they've got going on trump the product itself. And I think you also have people in Erewhon that are shopping more for lifestyle. And so there's a bit of posturing of, oh yeah, I love this product. And you love it because maybe it's trendy and it's influencer led and this and that. But I think try to go to the middle of America with something like that, to your point, no one's buying it.
Yeah, I did. I did also go to North Carolina recently and stopped at a gas station. And I was like, I can't find any of the brands that I see on LinkedIn in here.
Yes, I love the flyover states. I went to the Iowa State Fair. It's like a big event here in the United States. And it's all fried food on sticks. And it's just a healthy dose of reality of what the majority of the U.S. looks like. And also what innovation looks like there. So I guess you early on asked me about innovation. Innovation in the middle of the states is like pickle lemonade, pickle pizza, Spam burgers, fried bacon on a stick. It's more about flavor and like a mix of novelty and comfort simultaneously that tends to win. Formats that people are familiar with and interesting flavors on top.
Pickle flavors. There was a lot. I love pickles. There was a lot of pickle going on. Yeah. I bought a pickle bag. It was like, that was the snack. It was just a giant pickle in a bag. It's great. I'm not sure it would work here. Speaking of which, you've said before that you have a lot of love and respect for UK CPG and the design world here. Why is that?
I think there's just such a cleverness and sophistication to branding and design that comes from the UK. And if you think about a lot of the agencies that are most admired in the States, it's Pearl Fisher, it's Turner Duckworth, it's JKR, it's Bulletproof. Where did all of their founders come from, or where did their first shop start? In the UK. I think that the US just provides much more scale for work. There's cultural differences, so those things have to adapt. But as a young designer growing up, and being in San Francisco, some of my favorite agencies also had London offices, and I would look at the work coming out of London offices and just be so impressed, and also felt like so refreshing, because there's a lot of use of like character, both in the literal sense of characters, but also just personality through design and command of typography and color palettes. And I've been fortunate to go to the IFE show twice now, and every time I go, it's just, it encourages me to try to continue to learn as much as I can from the UK and try to practice that in the States.
Obviously, we all love to hear that.
Yeah, as you guys should be the best at it.
Reputation on the world stage is so strong in one area. You've mentioned a couple of them already, but you have 5 branding principles, which I love. I think they're on your LinkedIn header, aren't they? And I've seen you talk about them as well.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go through them. And for each, I'd love for you to build it out a little bit, give us a bit of definition, and then also a real world example of where you've seen it play out, and it can be good or bad. So the first one, which you have already mentioned, is people don't read, they recognize.
Yep, all the time. I'm just a big believer in this because people don't slow down, and a picture is literally worth 1,000 words. As human beings, we've evolved to look at symbols. It's why you can drive down a highway in the US, and if you see a golden arch, you know exactly what it is. Or a sports commercial can end with just a swoosh and no name. Or I can walk around holding a green cup and you know that I went to Starbucks. That's the ultimate power of branding. Coca-Cola does it the best. If I tell the audience now I've got a small box in my hand that's teal with a little ribbon on it, most people know that's Tiffany. The fact that you can do that just based on the general description is remarkable and a testament to, I think, what we all ultimately want to build, which is distinctiveness and recall. And I think the food and beverage industry is rife with very conventional design that's mostly typographically led. Most entrepreneurs, it's just, okay, write out my logo and then big photography and then lots of claims. And it's all just like alphabet soup. And I try to tell people, what are we building that people are going to recognize, not have to read? Because if I have to say I'm cool, I'm not cool. But if you look at me and you think I'm cool, then that's the ultimate sort of litmus test for things like that.
I think the other thing people don't understand about that is that you build those brands, have built those distinctive assets over many years and years of consistent, smart investment in the brand, in brand building, not just like performance marketing that has this like one-to-one row. That is not, yeah. That is not, you know, they've earned, like.
They've earned it, yeah.
They've earned it.
Commitment to assets and elements. But depending on the category you enter, you can create a lot of disruption. Bonds is a perfect example in the States. That orange box completely broke up all of the blue, white, red, and green Italian kind of colors of the category. Or I remember when Hippies launched at Expo West, which was done by Jay Caron, I think the London office, that yellow bag was so just powerful that every time you saw it afterwards, you're like, oh yeah, the yellow bag. And so it's just also, you create such great shorthand for the brands. And to your point, it only gets more powerful the more you invest in it.
Hippies did a really good job. When they launched in the UK, we all thought they were a Californian brand. And then when I think they launched,
yeah,
I thought they were a British brand. And I'm still not entirely sure which it was.
Yeah.
But they had to wear it like Californian, give peace a chance, aesthetic. Now they're not really here anymore and they're really big in the US.
Mm-hmm.
That's another story. Okay, so number two, the opposite of bravery isn't cowardice, it's conformity.
So this is something I tell a lot of entrepreneurs, in part because their strength is the ability to take risk. It's why they're starting their businesses in the first place. But oftentimes, young entrepreneurs look at whoever the category leader is and wants to replicate that playbook. And what I have to remind them is you will turn yourself into a two-bit player, a fast follower, a commodity, a generic version of something if you try to do that. What you need to do is find your own voice, be your best self. And that's where I think it's reminding clients that, like, look, it's not easy. It's not comfortable for everyone. But there is a formula to most CPG brands, and the ones that can figure out how to break it. We already talked about Liquid Death, we just talked about Bonza, we talked about Hippies. They all had their own unique formula. And that's what I try to get entrepreneurs to do and understand at the outset of their creative journey.
I guess it's learning which rules to follow, which are the things you do because they work, and then which ones to break. And that's the tricky part. Maybe we should write a book.
That is the tricky part. Yeah, we should write a book. And that's why we were hired, right? Because we help navigate some of those pitfalls that a first-time entrepreneur couldn't see themselves.
You've mentioned this one as well. Challenge the category, not the consumer.
Yeah, it's a little bit tied to the previous principle that we just talked through. But this one is really about understanding the codes of a category and deciding which one are you going to purposely break and how are you going to do it to make sure that it actually resonates with an intended audience, not alienates. Bonza is a great brand to talk about. I don't know if it's in the UK yet. The squeeze plastic bottle for olive oil. That was novel, and now everyone is fast following. That was disruptive in terms of the physical shape and the glass bottles that people were used to. It also made the notion of olive oil in the kitchen for most people at home much more accessible. I always looked at it as, God, I don't even extra virgin or this or that or expeller press. I'm like, I don't know these things. And they took what was natural behavior in the back of restaurants and they just brought it forward to consumers. And that to me is a great example of saying, no, we're not going to go in glass. No, we're not going to go in the square bottle. No, we're not going to be stuffy and focus on the premium qualities. We're going to bring illustration and character to the category for the first time. The Gander in New York City did that work. I'm friends with those founders. They're great at figuring out how to disrupt and live to this notion of challenge the category, not the consumer.
I heard though that Graza are now going into a glass bottle.
Yeah, and I just saw it at a store. It's actually quite genius. The reason why they're doing that is so that you can just fill your plastic bottles back up or attach a head to it. It's so funny how like old becomes new and new becomes old, and they've come full circle with that. They also have cans of olive oil in aluminum for the sustainability element. And there's still sustainability to the glass component too, but they're finding like different touch points and needs for the consumer can change that structural presentation, but their hallmark will always be the plastic bottle.
I think it's a good sign is when you look at something like that and you're like, but of course, why has no one done this before? And that's when you know you're in the right level of innovation, that it's acceptable, but it's different. It's like pushing something when you're like, this feels obvious, now it exists, but no one thought about it beforehand.
Yep.
So number four, research informs, strategy decides.
This is when I talk with more sophisticated clients. The bigger the business tends to get, the more conservative they are with change. Ruth, you and I were just talking about Tropicana and like the hesitation and the intimidation around some of that stuff. When you start to be able to afford research, what can sometimes happen is you just let the numbers lead you. And research can't tell you everything. It can tell you what certain parameters around what you tested for, but there's lots of decision-making moments. There's cool, you go to test your flagship product and it does well, but you've got this new pending innovation line. What about that? There's just a lot to consider. And so I think that some consumers also, if they come from the tech space, love to A/B test and get to the right solution that way. But you lose perspective of what you were trying to do in the first place. And so that's where I come back to. What was the strategy of what we were trying to accomplish and what are we doing here? What is the data telling us? But also read between the lines of the data is just as important. And so it's just more of a caveat for brand managers, heads of marketing, CMOs, not to take everything at face value.
And it's not always right. I've tested things that have not performed well, whether it be like a product or a flavor or like a flavor concept. And then we've just done it anyway. And then it's done really, there are always rule breakers too on there. And so you have to apply your own gut feel and strategy that you, like you say, but it's not,
Liquid Death would never have tested, but would have failed every single time. It would have, people hated it, too polarizing, et cetera. But if you listen to Mike Cesario and the team at Liquid Death talk about even their advertising strategy, they look for a 50 like-dislike ratio because that means it has made people feel a certain way and put people into camps, and those that love it are the audiences they care about. If you're shooting for a 98% acceptance rate, it's probably so bland and vanilla that, sure, everyone feels fine about it, but has very low like recall or distinctiveness at the end of the day. And that always sticks with me. That scares the shit out of me to say, oh yeah, let's make half of the audience hate this. But that is a different criterion strategy that they have that validates the research that they're seeing and they're looking to be informed with.
Which leads nicely on to number five, which is test to learn, not to win.
Yeah, and we already talked a little bit about this, but I'm just a big advocate of using design research, particularly with packaging, early on in the phase. There are some instances where I will be working with clients and I will actually pre-test my concept work before they've seen it and bring results to the table with me in the concept presentation. One, two, if I think I'm working with a really subjective founder, it'll help me combat some of that. But two, it'll help me cut off concepts that clearly are failing if I read through the qualitative data and there's nothing worth salvaging. But it also helped me learn not to do that in some other places or learn what is resonating. And even if I don't do it in advance of showing it to clients, I like to get clients even after just a round one concept presentation to take some of these things because you also want testable differences. If you wait too long and you just have iterative variations of things, you mitigate the ability to take real core learnings. And I think at the end of the day, all designers are problem solvers. The more sort of dots you give us to connect, the more dangerous we can be. I think consumer research has built up a bad reputation in our industry because it's mostly validation and it kills creativity at the end and forces us to make bad choices. If we front load it into the process and we let clients know we are not testing to win here, we are not looking for stars and stripes and go to print, and you calibrate that expectation, then I think everyone comes to the table with an open mind of, okay, maybe the brand didn't believe in all three, but we're going to learn something. And it might show you like, hey, actually, this one is working really well, but we otherwise would have said, no, not right for us. So that's why I believe in that principle.
I think you've mentioned subjectivity a few times, and I think that is the big challenge with design that I've always come up against, whether it's any sort of design work or creative, is just so subjective. And you need to bring consumers into the process, if only just to cut through the two co-founders, one who likes it, one who doesn't, and then one who's just shown their mum who hates it. And then you're like, oh, great, we've got to go back to the beginning now because of this. And it's a difficult it's difficult because it's subjective in a way that other disciplines and other areas of the business aren't.
Absolutely. And as designers, like, we've built our careers on taste, but we're also not always the consumer that we're designing for. And so I think a big part is regrounding us in the creative decisions that we're making and going, oh yeah, that's, I'm using a wrong design semiotic code here that's not being picked up in the way that I intended it to. So it holds us accountable too. And yeah, we haven't really talked about AI, but I think in a world of AI, subjectivity and our experiences of taste actually now become the differentiator on that side of the equation. Because if anyone can prompt something and it all the look of AI when you see it now, it does make the subjective elements of our careers actually more important, not less important.
Yeah, and maybe it's a opening of a can of worms starting to talk about AI. But it's the same with brand strategy or like marketing strategies. Yes, of course, you can go to ChatGPT and ask it to write your brand strategy. You have to use discernment because it is still wrong sometimes. And I think that's the other thing is people have stopped questioning it when offered. I found you can say something, it goes, yeah. And then you're like, hang on, really? And it goes, no, good point. And gives you a completely opposite perspective. It does still require a human with taste and knowledge to guide it, I think, for now. So we're safe for a little while longer,
you
hopefully.
You're totally right. And it's tough to be taught by AI. So if you're a first-time founder trying to build strategy or other things from it, it's mostly just going to reinforce your thoughts and tell you how brilliant you are, which is devastatingly dangerous because your ego loves it. And you start to drink the Kool-Aid and you're like, I can do no wrong now. And that's where I think it's interesting to be a young person in this day and age because you have so much tools, you have more information than ever. But if you don't learn from the previous generation and what they were able to do without those tools, then how will you know the difference between good or bad if it's everything's being served to you on a silver platter of ease and convenience? And yeah, a thumbs up, like, yeah, smart thought, blah, 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 blah. Yeah,
it's,
I don't know.
It's discernment, isn't it, is the new super. Mm. And discernment comes from experience a lot of the time, of past experience of what's good.
Making mistakes.
I feel like we're safe. We'll run it through chat, see if it gives us the thumbs up, tell us we're really clever, and then we can all feel really good about ourselves.
Yep.
So I'm going to go into a little quick fire round now as we're nearing the end. So brand redesign you wish you had done.
Back to Nature.
Oh, yeah. I know that one.
Which I came from a UK agency, which I was so surprised when I found out. That brand always sucked and was so sleepy. And they just injected so much life. And it's a great thing for the industry because people saw a huge, drastic change. And it was successful. It's nice. As a break from all of the big changes that doesn't work like Cracker Barrel, we need more of that.
Oh, brilliant. That's an agency called Love in the UK based up in Manchester. Just to give them their credit. What's your favorite brand in the US right now in CPG?
Favorite brand? I'll give a shout out to a company called Alira. They make these incredible sort of ancient grained cookie sandwiches. And I've gotten to know the founders and the team there. They just did a great redesign and a great product, great packaging. That's all you can ask for.
Favorite brand in the UK right now?
Ooh, man. Now you're asking me, putting me on the spot. Favorite brand in the UK would be Feisty Soda. I got to meet Vi Cutting. She's doing cool things. It's a very interesting and provocative space. Yeah, I'm excited to see how she does.
Yeah, nice choice. Best piece of advice you've ever been given and who gave it to you?
My design teacher in college. He said, make your mistakes on someone else's dime. And that was a great piece of feedback, basically telling me, go get a job. I always knew I had aspirations to run my own agency or business. And I had a friend that did that right out of college. And I think his career had not accelerated as fast as mine did because I was able to make a bunch of mistakes, but I didn't have to pay for it firsthand.
But also, you were probably a bit insulated by a team in that sort of environment. So you can make some mistakes and there's other people around there to fix them versus when you're on your own.
Yep.
Highest.
Yep, exactly.
If you weren't doing what you're doing now, what would you be doing?
I'd be designing shoes and or just traveling in a van across the United States. I've been to all 50 states already, but I love flyover places and going to overlook cities like Des Moines and finding the cool things there.
I was going to say
cultural anthropologist.
Eating bacon on a stick somewhere in Iowa.
Yeah, and going to convenience stores and
CPG guilty pleasure brand that you're not actually guilty about?
Ooh, this is a good one. A True Fruit comes to mind. It's a brand of like frozen fruit enrobed in chocolate. My wife and I housed down like a small little bag, and then I realized there were 8 servings in the bag. At first, I was like, there's no fucking way that's 8 servings. It's just, I feel good about it because it's whole fruit and then I get chocolate. And so that to me is really delicious.
So final question that we ask every guest, in your opinion, what makes a brand of tomorrow?
People. I mean, we talked about AI. We talked about the need for strategy over data. We've talked about audiences. Everything comes back down to people. And I often get asked, what's my favorite brand or favorite project? And it's always correlated to my favorite clients. I think the best relationships build the best work. And so at the end of the day, everything comes back to people.
Great answer. Thanks so much for coming on, Fred.
Ruth, it was a pleasure. Thank you.